Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandaisy.
And we are the Shock Doctors. In this episode, we're going to be discussing scary stories to tell in the dark, which is, for those of you who've been living under a rock for the past, 25, 30 years, an adaptation of a rather popular horror anthology series for the youth, which I never read because I was chicken shit, but Matt was a big fan.
Yeah, I mean, I was also chicken shit, but I was that particular breed of chicken shit that wants to, like, prove that it isn't. Because, like, closing one of those books prematurely makes you feel like a coward when you're in elementary school. It's like losing a bet with yourself or with the author, I guess. I distinctly remember sitting in the library in my elementary school and, like, poring over the illustrations and feeling my blood run cold in, you know, broad daylight, surrounded by people. Also, it's not like I was reading them alone in my room or something, but it was, yeah, no, I mean, those illustrations, and it is all about the illustrations, all due deference to Alvin Schwartz. I don't know. I'm going to heap praise on the look of those books as we go on, because the creature design in this movie actually does reflect them pretty accurately for the most part.
Yeah. On the flip side, I left a theatrical showing of Men in Black 2 5 minutes in because I was freaked out. So
when the Victoria's Secret model ate the guy? Or was it the giant worm?
I don't even remember what happens at the beginning of that one.
It was all just too stimulating.
Because that's the shitty one.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I remember about the opening minutes of that movie is Patrick Warburton getting his brain scrambled by the memory stick.
Yeah. Anyway, so, yeah. You were at least a more adventurous coward in your youth than
I aspire to be an adventurous coward.
So, yeah, this was originally going to be a Guillermo del Toro joint, but as with so many of his projects, he just has too much on his plate and wants to do too many things. And so he ends up producing and farming writing and directing duties out to other people.
Yeah.
In this case, to the director of Troll Hunter, and, Andre, he's Norwegian. I'm going to butcher this. Overdahl, I think.
Yeah. He also did, correct me if I'm wrong, Autopsy of Jane Doe.
Yes.
Which
yes,
we've previously cited on this show as being one of the only watchable blanking of first name, last name movies. So,
yes.
Props to Andre.
So, anyway, Matt, how about you take it away with a synopsis?
We open Halloween 1968. Donovan is playing on the radio. Vietnam War is in full swing. There's a wannabe Wolfman Jack growling on the airwaves about the draft and the upcoming election. And we're introduced to a merry band of misfit teens. Their names are Stella, who's kind of a bookworm slash aspiring writer in her own right, and Chuck and Augie, her two friends. And the three of them are conspiring to get back at a group of bullies, jocks, in the neighborhood who have been picking on them. They've got a Halloween prank in store.
The leader of this group of thugs is named Tommy. His goons are never given names, which is fine.
I mean, they're just the muscle. I mean, Tommy is a sociopathic bully right out of the Stephen King playbook. Graduated with honors from the Stephen King School of Bullying. He's the kind of bully where, like, there's an actual mad gleam in the eye. Like, there's something not quite right there.
Yeah.
So one of our erstwhile teen heroes, I believe it's Chuck, fishes one of his own turds out of the toilet with like a fish feeder net.
Yes, he does.
And they proceed to egg the jock's car when they go out trick-or-treating and toss a bag of flaming dookie into the driver's seat. Little do they know that one of them, it's Chuck's older sister, right?
Yeah, Ruth.
Is in the passenger seat. She's going on a date with Tommy, and then Tommy springs out of the car and chases them into the woods, wielding a baseball bat. We have previously seen Tommy batter up with a scarecrow named Harold, who is chilling out in the cornfields on the farm where he lives with his mother. There's a lot of mostly fairly under-the-radar foreshadowing near the beginning, setting up future payoff with different scary stories to tell in the dark.
For one thing, there's more to Harold than meets the eye.
Yes.
Which is saying something because Harold
is pretty imposing to begin with.
To meet the eye is enough.
It's a lot to take in, yeah. The three kids take refuge in a drive-in movie. Night of the Living Dead is the movie du jour. They hide in a car owned by a kid named Ramon, who's about their age, who's on the lam, just drifting from place to place, trying to keep a low profile.
Yeah, he's already had a run-in with, like, the town sheriff, who just gave him the sort of, better not cause any trouble, stranger, better hit the road real soon kind of treatment. Subtextually racist as opposed to overtly racist.
Speaking of which, the bullies, led by Tommy, try to get into the car, but they're foiled by the employees of the drive-in theater and a lot of unhappy moviegoers honking their horns and saying, "Hey, down in front." So Tommy hurls a racial slur at a Ramon for good measure and then hits the road. And in addition to the epithet, he also makes some crack about Stella's childhood and her mother running off when she was a young girl. And this upsets Stella, who regains her composure and then proposes that in order to salvage the evening, the four of them should hit up a local haunted house.
This haunted house belonged to the Bellows family, who was apparently at one time kind of the first family of this town, which is called Mill Valley. I spent most of the movie trying to figure out why that sounded familiar. And it's
is
because,
it Back to the Future?
Yes, it's Hill Valley. Yeah, I figured that out like 5 minutes to go.
Yeah, no McFly ever amounted to anything in the history of Mill Valley. That's right.
But anyway, this Bellows family, I guess they started up a paper mill. And that kind of, there's literally a line where one of the kids says, basically put this town on the map, the paper mill did. So they had this big old fancy house, and now it's abandoned. They had a daughter named Sarah who was different. It's not really specified early on how she was different, but the nickname for her was Strange Sarah, and apparently she was sort of locked in the basement, and somehow there was a wall that she could talk in the direction of that was audible from the outside, and so she'd talk to all these kids from the town, and a bunch of these kids died, and Sarah was held responsible. So
yeah, she would tell them a story, and they would subsequently take ill and perish. And all of this exposition is deployed in the manner of a spooky campfire tale as they're poking around this derelict old mansion. It's a lot to absorb. It's a little unwieldy, but they're kids in a haunted house trying to scare each other, so it's not as inelegant as it might sound, but it is just a whole truckload of worth of backstory. They find Ramon, more specifically, finds
a hidden door.
Yeah, a hidden door into the cellar, which is, we infer, where Sarah was kept locked up. And while they're in the cellar, Tommy and his crew, with Augie's older sister in tow, not Augie, Chuck's older sister in tow, show up and seal them down there.
Yeah, including Ruth.
Yeah, Ruth, the sister, after she protests. Yes, yeah. Yes. Stella finds a volume in the basement written in blood, Sarah's handiwork, no doubt. It's full of scary stories, and she, being a horror hound, invokes Sarah's name, says, "Sarah Bellows, tell me a story. Sarah Bellows, tell me a story.
Beastmas."
Yeah, Candyman, you get the idea. And then, mysteriously enough, the latch opens and they're released from the basement, you know, yeah. Supernaturally so.
Yeah, we see like a little bit of a shadow and maybe like a shadowy sort of claw almost reach out and pull on the latch. Of course, they don't see this because they're on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
So they head up, one of them asks, like, "Hey, who opened this?" And the consensus is, well, you know, who cares? Let's get out of here.
Yeah. Later that night, Stella is leafing through the book, which she has unwisely taken from the house, and sees a story. It's the most recent story in the book, and she runs her thumb over the title, and it smears. The ink, the blood, is fresh. The story is called Harold.
Yeah.
And it is about a boy named Tommy, whose greatest pleasure in life, when he's not talking smack about minorities, is wailing on the scarecrow in the cornfield outside his house. And she starts reading it, thinks nah. Like, it can't be.
Nah.
But sure enough, it is. Cue our first vignette taken straight from the original books, where Tommy, racist jock, is laid low by a perambulating scarecrow that stabs him with a pitchfork and turns him into a scarecrow. You see hay emerging from his mouth, eyes, and ears, and
sleeves, and yeah, just every, right. And pitchfork holes, etc.
You know, all of the normal human orifices.
And let me tell you, you can't really blame Tommy for hating this scarecrow, because it is horrifying to look upon. It's like a scarecrow by way of Leatherface.
I was about to say, it's like a scarecrow that Leatherface would have nightmares about. It looks like it's wearing a human skin burlap face. It's like a tanned leather situation.
Yeah, it's not like a canvas bag, no. Kind of traditional scarecrow head. It looks like human skin. And yeah, so he gets chased through the cornfield a few times, and yeah, turns into a scarecrow. So fuck Tommy, I guess. I mean, yeah. Fair enough. He is kind of a shitbag.
Yeah, and that's basically the consensus round town. I mean, it doesn't cause as much of a stir as you might expect. There are never any bodies when these characters go missing. They're always spirited away in such a way that there isn't much of a crime scene. Tommy is no exception. He's transmuted into straw. Yeah. And there's some speculation he was about to enlist and go serve in Nam.
Well, he had already enlisted,
I think.
The beginning of the movie, he's coming out of the recruiting station. So presumably his plan is, I don't know, to like finish out the school year or something. But the assumption is just that, well, you know, I guess he just wanted to go early. He wanted to go kill some commies.
Yeah, right. So. Well, the point being, the Viet Cong never get their hands on him because Harold got him first. So, but the word around town is that he just skipped town early to go make our country proud. Stella, though, is already connecting dots. Good on her. Horror movie protagonists are normally way slower on the uptake than this. And she elects to put the book back where it belongs. But Babadook style, it will not be gotten rid of. It just materializes back in her bedroom. Ramon comes over and finds it on her bookshelf.
Yeah, Ramon's been hanging around. He crashes for at least one night in her basement, unbeknownst to her father, because a little while back, after they came out of the Bellows mansion, they come out to find his car real messed up.
Yeah, the front hood says wet. I probably don't have to tell you what the back hood says.
Right.
And the tires are all slashed and the, you know, it's
windshield smashed, yeah, etc. Right. So he's taking it in to get serviced, which is his second encounter with the police chief, who saying, you know, heard you had a confrontation with Tommy what's-his-name, and he wouldn't have done this, would he? And, of course, Ramon doesn't want to talk to him. We just assume purely because
he doesn't want to implicate himself in a missing persons case.
Well, yeah, and also, particularly because he's of Mexican extraction.
Yeah, right.
And the racial undertones are pretty clear there.
Yeah. So if he was trying to keep his head down before, he certainly is now. I believe it's while Stella is freaking out about the book doing its boomerang act and coming back to her that they're flipping through it and a new story begins materializing on the page before
their
very
eyes.
You
are absolutely right. And this one is, unfortunately, about somebody we like a lot better than Tommy.
Yes.
It's about Augie.
The story is called The Big Toe. The gist of it, the campfire tale, it's as old as the hills. I usually heard it as The Golden Arm growing up. It's about like a thief steals a prosthetic arm. It's a grave robbing situation, and then the person comes back and says, you know, the corpse, that is to say, who took my arm, so on and so forth. Here it's who took my big toe, because yep. the guy made soup with it.
Yeah, some fucking maniac took this toe out of the ground and then threw it in a stew because, yeah, that toe looks juicy.
Yeah, right.
That's a totally normal fucking thing to do.
Yeah, this is one where you kind of find yourself rooting for the cadaver just to make short work of this maniac.
But in this particular version of the story, Augie's not the one who made the stew. He just kind of finds it in his fridge after his mom and stepdad fuck off to Europe or wherever the hell they went.
Yeah.
And didn't leave any other food in the house. So Stella gets a jump on this in plenty of time. She's shouting over the walkie-talkie. They all have walkie-talkies. Shouting over the walkie-talkie, like, don't eat anything. And Augie's like, what are they talking about? I'm going to eat some of this weird stew that I don't know the origin of.
Mystery stew, my favorite, just like mom used to make.
And it sure was enough,
just like mom presumably did make, in fact.
I thought.
Yeah.
He ends up finding a toe in his mouth, which is kind of gross. They're telling him that he's supposed to be hearing a creepy voice saying, "Who took my toe?" And at long last, he finally starts actually hearing it. And then, the corpse materializes. When we first see its face, it looks like the picture from the cover of the first volume of Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, I believe.
It's one of the illustrations. Yeah, I would have to. I have these books on my shelf at home, and I think that the first volume has what can only be described as a spectral zombie clown on it. I will do my due diligence during the break, and we will report back on that.
Fair enough. Anyway, basically it plays hide and seek with Augie for a bit. There's a bait and switch. He's looking on his bed, and he's under the bed, and then he finds out it is also under the bed. Meanwhile, Stella and Ramon are rushing over the few blocks from her house to his house, but they are too late. Augie is dragged to hell, leaves fingernail marks in the floor under his bed that lead directly into the baseboard on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And he's gone.
So the following day, Stella and Ramon are briefing Chuck and Ruth on the situation. Ruth doesn't buy it, thinks it's all a sick gag, storms off. Chuck takes it pretty seriously. They try to burn the book. It is fireproof. Surprise, surprise. And they go to a place. This is where I reveal myself to be millennial trash. Where would you go in the 60s to conduct the kind of research that they do? Is it like just like some kind of town hall or like record?
Yeah, it's like the town library or city hall where they dig up town records, like vital statistics, because they're trying to cross-reference the names and the stories with names of people from the town, names of kids who disappeared, and also get more information on the Bellows family, which they do.
Yeah, and in so doing, they learn that the first several stories in the book are about Sarah's immediate family, who all vanished within a year of her hanging herself.
Under mysterious circumstances.
Yeah, right. And as they're conducting this research, a new story begins writing itself.
Yes.
The story is called The Red Spot.
And there's a bit of a bait and switch for a hot second because Chuck is eating something that presumably has ketchup on it. He gets some on his shirt. And so they see The Red Spot and then they look at his shirt and he freaks the fuck out. But then it starts talking about a young girl and Ruth's name appears and they're like, oh, snap. Ruth has gone off to her school because she is in the school's production of Bye Bye Birdie. Presumably she's playing the lead. It's just the impression I get. And she's got a big old spider bite on her face.
Yeah, she ran afoul of a spider web when they were locked in the basement of the Bellows house earlier in the movie.
Yeah.
She's revealed to be pretty arachnophobic.
Yeah,
as any sensible person is, I would wager. But in no time at all, this spider bite on her face expands to the size of a tennis ball.
Yeah,
and she runs into the bathroom and tries to drain it because she's about to go on stage, and a shitload of hatchlings come scurrying out.
Yeah,
and drive her irretrievably insane.
Yeah,
as this was one of the most. This is in, I think, the third Scary Stories book. It's the one that I don't own. I have the first two volumes, and I'm almost grateful to not have this one because that illustration is just so upsetting. It was the first thing I can remember looking at in my formative years and just thinking like, Jesus Christ, this was not.
Nope.
This was not meant for my eyes.
Yeah. So thankfully, although they do not get there early enough to prevent her from going mad, the crew does get there in time to at least save her life.
Because
they're sort of hustling over to the school and looking for the correct bathroom because they know she's in a bathroom.
Yeah, because they've read the story as it's being written.
And they find her while she's covered in spiders and her brother douses her with a bucket of water and they get her out of there. But yeah, she's She's crazy. This wasn't immediately clear to me. Like, they cart her away to an ambulance with, like, a bandage on her face and stuff. But at the end of that same scene, her brother's like, Ruthie's gone. And I'm like, she's not dead. But it's shortly thereafter revealed that she's in an asylum.
Yeah, so. 1968, I guess, off to a padded room with you.
A
spider-proof one, God willing.
Yeah, let's hope.
We got another exposition dump in the form of a visit to the home of Lulu Baptiste.
Yeah, who is revealed during the records room search to have been the daughter of, I guess, the Bellows' maid or some form of domestic servant who helped to take care of Sarah and also just the house.
Yeah, and was rumored to have taught her some kind of voodoo, although that actually bears no fruit. Lulu pretty much shoots that down, which I was kind of pleased to hear because it's a little bit of a racist old trope.
Yeah, a little
and this movie otherwise has like fairly progressive politics, so that would have been like one kind of annoying blind spot, but they nip that in the bud. And the only thing that they really glean from this is that Sarah didn't hang herself at home. She committed suicide when she was hospitalized. And so they resolve to go to the hospital to conduct more research.
They get there. Chuck is talking about his nightmares regarding the Red Room, which they discover at the hospital is the records room. Red is an acronym. It's like Record Exploration Depot or something like that.
Something kind of tortured like that, yeah.
It's clearly a backronym.
Yeah, right.
of some kind. And he's basically, nah, fuck that. So he's wandering around the hospital trying not to get caught, trying to get to the top floor as far away from the Red Room as possible while they go down.
Yeah, and in his attempts to avoid the Red Room, he incurs the wrath of some security guards who start chasing him up and down the hospital.
They set off an alarm, which in turn turns the entire third floor into a red room.
Yeah, womp womp.
So,
yeah, it's the lights cut out and the alarm is raised and the whole hallway is just kind of suffused with red light. So he's pretty boned. That was the probably the eeriest sequence in the movie, the most Korean, at least.
Yes.
With the specter that comes a calling for him.
Yeah.
This is all juxtaposed with Ramon and Stella in the RED room going over some old files. They find a wax cylinder recording of Sarah being tortured with electricity by her brother, who was a doctor, who is trying to get her to confess to the poisoning of all these neighborhood children who turned up dead.
In fact, it was mercury from the paper mill the whole time.
Yeah, it was runoff from the mill that got into the town water supply.
So basically, the Bellows were just trying to dump all the responsibility for their malfeasance onto their... I guess it turns out she was an albino. They're like unusual albino daughter that everyone's already afraid of.
Exactly. So it was a very convenient boogeyman kind of situation.
And
speaking of boogeymen.
Right. Well, it's fitting that the Chuck stuff going on right now is sort of climaxing in terms of creep factor because this wax cylinder is very effective.
Yeah.
Sarah is being electroshocked during this torture.
Uh-huh.
And every time she says something that her brother doesn't like, which is basically the whole time.
Basically every time she opens her mouth, yeah.
She gets electroshocked and the screams are almost not human. I don't know if that's just a matter of like low recording quality on a fucking wax cylinder, but damn, it's unsettling.
Yeah. What's more unsettling is what's happening upstairs with the pale lady, who's this kind of flabby, pallid creature waddling down the hall after Chuck. He keeps turning down these kind of blind alleys, all these 90 degree turns, and she's confronting him every step of the way, getting closer and closer.
Yeah, there end up being four of her that sort of converge, and then it's down to one, and she just kind of hugs him to her and swallows him up.
Yep.
No fun.
Stella and Ramon are doing what they always do, which is arrive slightly too late to make a meaningful difference. I mean, they show up and find the site where he had just been absorbed into the pale lady.
Yeah, they find his girly pen, you know, one of those where you've got a clothed woman and then you turn it the other way around and fluid drains out and she's naked or she's wearing lingerie or whatever.
Yeah.
So they know he was just there. And
he died as he lived. And so then they're apprehended by hospital staff and subsequently carted off to the police station.
Yeah. Stella is talking to her dad and saying a lot of ominous sounding shit that he justifiably does not understand.
Yeah, this is happening over the phone.
Yeah, about how I think I'm going to die. And if I disappear, just know I didn't leave you. I would never do that. He's trying to tell her, wasn't your fault that your mom left. Just please tell me what's going on. I want to help. And I wasn't quite clear on why she didn't at least try and say something. I don't know if she was trying to protect him, maybe, but it wasn't immediately clear to me.
Yeah.
But in any case, she...
The rules aren't really made clear to her either, so maybe she's just erring on the side of caution.
Yeah. So she wraps up the conversation with her dad. He's not ready to wrap up, obviously, but she hangs up on him. Sheriff shows up and asks if her dad's coming to get her, and she says no. Meanwhile, the sheriff reveals that Ramon, previously claiming to be named Ramon Rodriguez, is actually Ramon Morales, who is a draft dodger. He ducked a recent draft notice and has been on the... This is why he's on the lam, driving cross-country. So she's given the opportunity to just leave because she hasn't really done anything. And Sheriff kind of takes pity on her because of her history and whatnot, but she's not going to leave Ramon. So they both get thrown in the cells for the night.
Yeah, and she also isn't giving him an answer he likes in that they just keep repeating that they're being afflicted by a haunted book.
Which he obviously thinks is horseshit.
Yeah, that's disappearing all of their friends. So he locks them both up to kind of teach them a lesson. Whereupon a new story is written, one that I have to say I don't remember too vividly. The name of the story is Me Ty Doughty Walker, I think. Just kind of a nonsense phrase. Ramon is relating to Stella. They're in adjacent cells that he had an older brother who was shipped off to Vietnam earlier that year and returned in pieces. And he's afraid that the book, Sarah, whoever, the entity,
is going to capitalize on that. And sure enough,
a bunch of pieces fall down the chimney. Do police stations have chimneys typically?
It's not immediately clear. So the sheriff is alone in the police station with the two of them. And the lights go out while he's checking on them. And he goes out to investigate. And there's a dog there that I don't remember being there, but he seems to recognize the dog.
Yeah.
He calls it by name. The dog is staring at a fireplace and barking at it in this weird rhythmic way. I originally thought that the dog was going to be starting to say this nonsense phrase. I thought it was building to speech.
Yeah, bullet,
turns out it didn't go that
dodge
route. But
there.
Yeah, it wasn't clear to me if, like, this is a whack-ass police station that always had a fireplace, or if that appeared in the course of these haunted shenanigans.
Yeah, anything's possible, I guess.
But as per usual, the book has, like, fallen onto the floor and is open, and it's kind of writing itself, and the cop is understandably alarmed. But he's even more alarmed when a human-ish head falls down the chimney and rolls out to him and says this phrase, which is, again, Matt,
Me Ty Doughty Walker,
in a much creepier cadence than that, kind of growly. And I don't remember exactly what the cop says, but it's funny. It's something along the lines of, are you serious?
Yeah, I think he says, are you shitting me? And then he plugs the head full of lead, as ineffectual as you would imagine, and then, you know,
the rest of the body falls down in pieces and assembles itself
awfully crudely, like, not in the, you know, it needed a second draft. They're not all where they belong. All those bones did not knit together very fluidly. But
apparently Ramon is familiar with this creature. He calls it the Jangler Man. I guess that's from some kind of campfire tale he heard.
Yeah, there was some lip service paid earlier to the idea that Augie was also in his youth frightened of the big toe folktale. So these stories are being plucked from their imaginations.
Right. And the Jangler Man disposes of the sheriff quite quickly, just snaps his neck and then hurls him like across the room and into the cell's room against the bars.
Yeah, across the room and kind of around the corner a little bit. It, like, if my spatial awareness is on point here, it's like he curves it like in Wanted.
I think it's a little more of a straight shot than that, but maybe. It's immaterial. The Jangler Man does that, and then it comes inside and is trying to push through the bars to get at Ramon, screaming at him, calling him coward. Meanwhile, Stella is trying to get the keys from the sheriff's belt. She does. She gets out, lets Ramon out, and they book it. And they decide to split up after Ramon grabs keys to a cop car. She's going to run off to the Bellows mansion and tell Sarah that she knows the truth and that she's going to tell the truth about Sarah didn't kill all those kids and so forth, and it was her family.
Yeah, and Ramon is going to keep Mr. Bojangles distracted.
Going to try and outrun the Jangler Man. So he's driving. The Jangler Man catches up real quick, pounds on the hood and on all the windows and stuff, and eventually Ramon crashes into a fire truck, I think it is, and pins the Jangler Man, who just promptly disassembles himself. and falls loose.
Then reconstitutes himself, yeah.
Stella books it over to the mansion. She goes inside and is shouting for Sarah, trying to tell her what she needs to tell her.
Whereupon she receives a blast from the past, which has happened once before when Chuck was in the attic earlier. This was shortly before they discover Sarah's basement cell. Yeah. Chuck is momentarily transported 100 years into the past, and he sees an old lady and a dog in a well-furnished, well-lit room, and then is spat back into the present, which is to say 1968.
Yeah, and that dog looks almost exactly like the dog in the police station.
Yeah, that tripped me up too.
Yeah, that contributed to my confusion. Presumably that was intentional. I don't think they would do that by mistake, but I don't know quite what they were trying to do. But anyway, so yeah, Sarah is now kind of like trapped in 1898 or whenever exactly it's supposed to be. And Ramon sees that a story is being written about her in the pages of Sarah's book.
Which is cheating, I think, because previously Sarah had only picked off one victim a night, and now she's doubling down. But it's the climax. I guess you got to raise the stakes.
Yeah, so Ramon is fleeing also to the Bellows Mansion. He remains in the present day, fleeing the Jangler Man. Sarah is trying to dodge the members of the Bellows family because she discovers that she, to their eyes, is Sarah.
Mm-hmm.
Fleeing. She runs into young Lulu, who directs her to hide under the kitchen table and then attempts to mislead the other Bellows into thinking she's elsewhere.
They don't buy it.
Stella gets dragged out and thrown in the cell, where she encounters Sarah, who is an aggressive ghoul.
A skeletal wraith of sorts. And Stella says, look, I'm going to tell everyone the truth. I'm going to tell your story. And she starts writing it in the book in her own blood with Sarah's old pen.
But she's also saying, like, yeah, all those kids before, that was your family. You didn't do anything wrong then. But everything you're doing now, that's on you. You got to let go of all this rage.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, Ramon is dangerously close to getting shredded by the Jangler Man.
Yeah, getting jangled to death, but his insides all jangled up.
Finally, Stella gets through to Sarah, who just kind of lets out one final bellow. Scream.
Well played.
And just sort of dissolves. And Ramon and Sarah are reunited, and they leave the house. And that's basically the end of the movie. Yeah. Ramon, you know, she sees him off at the bus station where he's going to go off to NAM, I guess, because he's been drafted, and she's going to write him every day. She's already written him one letter she hands to him.
Not in her own blood this time.
No. Pen, I think, or pencil.
Yeah, she has written up Sarah's story, this expose of the forefathers, local forefathers, and their
malfeasance.
Yeah, right.
got it published in the school newspaper, right. You know, first prize story contest or whatever.
Ruth has been released from the sanitarium, I guess. She's
apparently she's not gone.
Yeah, no.
Which is good, I guess.
She seems to be recuperating, and the two of them have resolved to try to retrieve somehow everyone who got by Sarah Bellows.
Or you know, at least Augie and Chuck. Maybe Tommy will stay where he is.
Right. Yeah, I don't know. He probably doesn't want to come back.
Yeah.
It's, you know, I would hate to see... If there's anything worse than seeing a person turn into a scarecrow, it'd be seeing a scarecrow turn into a person. I don't want to see all that hay get re-inhaled.
Yeah, I don't know, maybe.
So yeah, I mean, the movie ends on this kind of would-be optimistic note, which kind of belies what's actually happening. I mean, everyone who died is still dead, and Ramon has a better than decent chance of dying in a rice paddy, but it's all... I mean, it's this kind of slightly awkward sequel hook. It's, you know, basically tune in next week on Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. We're going to try to get Augie and Chuck back.
Yeah, I don't know if there's actually any intention of making a second one and packaging together some of the stories that weren't used in this movie.
And there are reams plenty of them. Yeah, exactly. And
packaging some of those together in an overall narrative of, yeah, let's get these people back.
Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed this movie enough to buy a ticket for that one. I'm a fan of the source material. And
so presumably if this makes enough money, we'll see something along those lines.
Yeah, and so far so good on that front. It's been making a pretty penny, last I checked.
Well, on that note, we're going to go ahead and take our break, and then we'll be back with our thoughts in just a moment.
Okay, what if what happens in the book is exactly what's happened for real? Oh my God. Augie!
Stella!
Listen, you're in the next story.
We're reading it right here.
It's a corpse looking for her missing toe.
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at ShockDoctorsPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/ShockDoctorsPod, or check us out on iTunes. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at ShockDoctorsPod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
I'm afraid that we woke something up.
You shouldn't have taken the book.
We've got to stop it.
And we're back. So, Matt, what did you find in your Google search about illustrations?
Yeah, the first edition cover. I didn't even mention this detail because I thought surely I must have fabricated it. But no, the spectral zombie clown is in fact smoking a pipe. And he has a kind of like gleeful, mischievous, contented smile on his face. It's weird. I mean, those books towed a very fine line. I mean, the covers had to look at least a little bit more kid-friendly. I mean, it's still pretty ghastly and ghoulish, but it's got a little bit of color in it, first of all, which is why I say clown. There's like a little blue, a little red. It's got kind of a carnival-esque air to it, grease paint. And then you get the book open, and it's just this monochromatic hellscape. It's just like blacks and whites, but mostly blacks. Just this kind of abyssal, like all the figures look twiggy or like inky, and they've all got little black tendrils coming off of them. Like the artist literally like used too much ink when they drew the damn things, and it splotched the page. It just looks messy, and but in a way that's like frightening. It's like they're going to come oozing off the page and into the real world. And I kind of wish that Sarah's book in the movie had illustrations in it, because those drawings in the book look like the etchings of a mad person. They look like something that you would draw if you were entombed in the basement by an abusive family member.
Yeah.
I don't know. That could be a rights issue. I know that like newer editions of the Scary Stories books haven't all had those Stephen Gammell illustrations. But the monsters in this movie are based on the original Stephen Gammell drawings. So I have to assume that they could have used the original illustrations and incorporated those into Sarah's tome that they find in the cellar. I don't know. I just feel like those books for me were all about the drawings, and then the words themselves just sort of sealed the deal in a lot of cases. But I guess it's a motion picture. You know, the picture part of it is what you're actually watching. So maybe it would have been redundant. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe.
Overall, I enjoyed it. I think setting it in the late 60s is a little bit of a stroke of genius, not just because it gets away from today's cynical teenagers with their iPhones and their TikToks and what have you. It gets us back to a slightly more...
And their Instabooks.
Yeah, right. It gets us back to a slightly more innocent age when these campfire stories maybe had a little bit more oomph, a little bit more presence, it cast a slightly longer, darker shadow. You can take the idea of a jock bully a little more seriously than if this movie were set nowadays.
Yeah, these days even the jocks are woke.
Yeah, right. No, I mean, and he's got the Letterman jacket on and everything. It's very classic. The whole thing, the whole presentation is very classic. And what I like about putting it in 68 is that, you know, these kids, they talk to each other on their walkie-talkies. They wear costumes on Halloween. They're misfits and weirdos. It scratches the exact same itch as Stranger Things or It or whatever else, but it's not just another 80s throwback. It's got a little bit of a different flavor to it. It's kind of like, you know, like all those 80s movies that Stranger Things and It and whatever else is riffing on. That's kind of, and I'm not the first person to point this out, there's a nostalgia cycle every 20 or 30 years. Our culture cannibalizes itself and spits itself back out like some kind of cinematic Ouroboros. But those 80s movies about the kids going around their neighborhood on bikes, E.T. and what have you, is sort of an idealized version of the childhoods of the filmmakers of that era. So it's like Joe Dante, Steven Spielberg, whoever else, thinking about the middle 60s or whatever, whenever they were kids, 50s, 60s, you know, fudge the numbers a little bit. So I think that setting this movie in the 60s like gets to the source a little bit in a way that I found kind of pleasing, not just because I'm suffering from 80s fatigue, which I very much am, but because I think that seeing those misfit kids on their walkie-talkies in like the Vietnam era is just like getting a little bit closer to the truth in a way, I think, where in the 80s it was already like one generation removed. It was already a product of nostalgia, I guess, is what I'm saying. So this movie kind of cuts out the middleman, if that makes any sense.
Some, I think. I think I get what you're getting at.
It makes more sense than me, Ty Doughty Walker, which, you know, is now the standard I will use for all of my rhetoric.
Yes. Yes, as long as I can make more sense than me, Ty Doughty Walker, I have not gone insane.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, the creature design in this movie is pretty solid. I already talked at length about Harold and how he was Scarecrow by way of Leatherface, and that's pretty fucking horrifying. The corpse, for those of you who have seen that, what turned out not to be a cover image, but one of the first few results if you Google image search Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, it's sort of a creepy, ghostly corpse face, mangled,
sunken, yeah,
sunken
eye sockets, what have you.
That translated pretty directly to the who took my toe corpse.
Mm-hmm.
And that was pretty effective. I don't have as big of a thing, obviously, about spiders as Matt does, but a bunch of spiders bursting out of a bulge in your own face is horrifying.
Yeah, no,
I will readily grant that.
No two ways about it.
And yeah, the Jangler man's fucked up. No two ways about it. So, yeah, in general, we got some creepy ghouls in this.
And it's funny because we ragged on Annabelle Comes Home and the Conjuring universe in its totality for just throwing monsters at the wall and seeing what sticks. And this movie sort of does that as well, but it worked for me for the most part, maybe because I grew up with these stories and these drawings, although I don't think that's it. I think here Sarah Bellows is not that she doesn't have a personality so much per se. I mean, she's not that distinctive an antagonist, but it's very apparent that these are all just kind of
extensions of her.
Yeah, in like a Pennywise-esque kind of way. Whereas all of the Conjuring monsters,
they're explicitly just drawn there by Annabelle. They're not Annabelle.
Yeah, right, exactly.
They say as much. Like, Annabelle's a conduit or whatever. Let's not get too far into that again.
But yeah, no.
They're all their own discrete haunted objects or demons or whatever. Yeah. And also,
this movie, also because it's set up as a series of vignettes, very, like, kind of cordoned off, discrete vignettes, at least for the bulk of the movie, because it's like one victim per night, one new story per night. The movie never feels crowded. It's a succession of monsters that keeps things fresh, but it's not like you ever have the Pale Lady and Mr. Bojangles, like, competing for screen time.
Right. And Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, it's built into the fabric of what the movie is supposed to be.
Yeah.
Whereas, like we talked about with Annabelle Comes Home, it just feels so much like they've got Annabelle and they're like, okay, now we know Annabelle's not good enough by herself, so here's all this other crap.
Right.
And they just kind of throw it in willy-nilly when they need another demon or whatever.
Yeah, I have to say, I have a lot of fondness for retro horror anthology films, some of which, you know, I'm talking like the 70s would probably be the heyday of this kind of horror filmmaking. Vault of Horror springs to mind, this is from the 90s, but like Tales from the Hood, Tales from the Crypt, slightly more classic example.
Creepshow.
Yeah, Creepshow, another standout. That kind of thing where there's maybe a little bit of adhesive holding the whole thing together, but they're basically just self-contained narratives. Because I love, at least conceptually, I love horror short films. So just getting a smorgasbord of horror shorts is like, I'm like happier than a pig in shit. It's like my favorite kind of movie when it's done well. That part probably goes without saying. But even the bad ones are a good time. So I was dismayed to learn that Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, the 2019 film directed by Andre such and such, was gonna be like at least 50% frame narrative, if not more. I think that the frame narrative that they settled on gets the job done. It's very functional, and it mostly doesn't get in the way of the kind of structure that I wanted this movie to have, which I said before is like a series of vignettes. It's like just one monster after another. And as far as these things go, it's a damn sight better than like the Goosebumps movie. Like this could have been a very Jumanji-esque kind of family romp. Maybe, you know, it would have still been like PG-13, but it could have been a lot more toothless than it turned out being. I still think it's relatively tame in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah, overall, it's fairly tame.
Yeah, but it's got its fair share of decent spooks in it.
Yeah, again, the Pale Lady and Sarah screaming on the wax cylinder, both at the basically the same time.
Right.
Pretty unsettling.
Yeah, it's good shit. I do think that towards the end of this movie, it gets bogged down more and more so by its invented Sarah Bellows family malfeasance kind of baggage. I think that as it gets deeper and deeper into its own lore, it loses something for me. It lost a little bit of momentum towards the end, and I think it was just getting too far afield from the kind of anthology structure that I really hunger for in these kinds of movies.
Well, and the climax goes a little soft too at the very end, because it's basically just like
Sarah being guilt tripped into not being an evil ghost anymore.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah,
it's
I didn't
know,
buy that.
It's the same kind of letdown, and I'm gonna list off a couple of examples that I have different levels of negative feeling toward.
It was sort of Flanagan-esque.
I was gonna go with Mike Flanagan.
Yeah,
a lot of his stuff ends on sort of like the power of family bonds and what have you, which again, is kind of soft, but I don't mind quite so much with Flanagan. I mind it more with James Wan.
Yeah, right.
Again, these Annabelle movies, which aren't his to direct, but they're his baby. And also the
they're
Conjuring
at least his
movies.
Grandchildren,
right.
If not his children.
Right.
He and, sired the things that sired them.
Yeah, and these all end with, you know,
Patrick Wilson grabbing a fucking guitar.
Well, and demons being defeated by the power of love and faith and all this stuff. And it's just kind of like, it's a little hokey and it's a little silly. Yes. And I'm not saying that every horror movie needs to end bleak or anything, but just having a little bit more punch wouldn't hurt.
Yeah, and this movie is at cross purposes with the ending too, because it kind of does end bleak. I mean, Ramon is being shipped overseas, which even if he survives is going to be a completely traumatic experience, and Augie and Chuck are still out of the picture.
That's the other thing I don't get. They seem to have an awful lot of confidence, Stella and I guess Ruth, that they can use the stories in Sarah's book to help figure out how to retrieve Augie and Chuck and whoever else. But with Sarah presumably gone when she makes herself explode, basically.
When she screams herself into the great beyond.
Into oblivion. If Sarah's gone, then how... I don't know. I don't know how they can get these people back.
Yeah, the
I feel like they would need Sarah for that.
Lulu says that there was never any magic, there was only rage. I believe that's the exact line. So once, and that word rage comes up again during the guilt trip, the climactic guilt trip.
Right.
So yeah, once the rage, if that's the essential ingredient, supposedly, then yeah, it's been dealt with. The spirit is at peace. This, like, house is clean.
Right. So if your thought is that these people are still out there somewhere, you would think if they were going to come back, they would have just like popped back out into the regular world.
Yeah, right, like Endgame style.
Right. When Sarah dispatched herself to the great beyond.
Yeah.
Like Chuck would have just fucking winked into existence on the third floor of the hospital and just started screaming, probably.
Yeah.
And
Augie would have reemerged from the wall fingernails first.
Right. And the fact they didn't, I don't know. I mean, we'll have to see what Scary Stories 2 looks like, but conceptually, I don't see how that works.
Yeah, it's shoehorned in right at the very end, and it ends the movie on this kind of would-be optimistic note that is not supported by the actual events happening. Like I was shocked to see Ramon not say, like, peace and hit the road again and continue dodging the draft or, like, try to hoof it across the border to Canada or something. Like, I did not think that's where his character arc was going.
And I did not think that Ruth was going to be getting out of the mental institution, certainly not that quickly. I mean, like, I don't know exactly what the timeline is meant to be, but it certainly feels like maybe she was there for less than a week. And that's right. Like, she was irretrievably insane. No, wait, she's fine.
Well, her cheek is still pretty fucked up, so that might be...
Well, no, it looks scarred over, so okay. Maybe it's supposed to have been, like, at least a month, but still... To go from, again, apparently irretrievably insane to well enough to be released back out into the world, you'd think that would take years. Like, they would have to be adults at minimum.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I don't know.
The other thing that Lulu says, and this comes up in the opening and closing narration too, is that stories can hurt, but they can also heal. So there's some vague gesture in the direction of, like, well, you know, stories killed these people. Maybe stories can bring them back. I really feel like they don't have a game plan for the sequel, for, like, how they're actually going to pull off this magic trick, pulling Chuck and Augie out of the hat again, you know.
Yeah, I mean, presumably they got at least 6 months to a year to develop that.
Yeah,
so.
Right. So I just don't think they're going to. I would be very impressed if they came up with a satisfactory solution to that problem, because right now I don't see one, although I've been contemplating it for all of 90 minutes tops since the lights came back up. I don't know. Maybe by the time the sequel comes out, Guillermo del Toro will have finally perfected the technology. I don't know. I just feel like he's definitely got a couple botched clones in his basement laboratory. He's had to like mercy kill a bunch of kind of brundle fly, you know, monstrosities that just didn't come out quite right. Needed a little more time in the oven.
Soon.
Yeah.
Soon I will make all the movies.
Soon, yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Never again will we have to watch Pacific Rim Uprising.
Soon, my darlings.
Let me tell you, it was one of the most disappointing experiences of my life.
I never saw it.
I went in with severely curtailed expectations because I knew he wasn't directing it, and I still came out wildly disappointed. So,
have you seen Men in Black 2, like in your adulthood?
Oh, yeah. No, oh, okay. I eventually circled back around to it.
Yeah, the only part of that movie that I have any affection for is Patrick Warburton going, "Good pie." It's right before he gets his memory wiped, his noodle cooked. Where was I? Oh yeah, the other thing that this movie gains from its period setting is the 60s backdrop. It's not just the looming specter of Nam, it's also an election year, 1968.
So, the Nixon year.
Yeah, right. So all the stuff with the jangly gentleman cavorting around the police station is there's a TV set on the desk in the police station that shows the votes being tallied and Nixon flashing the peace sign and everything. So the movie doesn't dwell on it that much, which is good because like trying to confer meaning onto a movie by just juxtaposing it with historical happenings can often seem a little desperate. To me, here there's not like really a correlation that I could see. It was just kind of, it just sort of compounded the feeling of doom, I guess. It just sort of amplified the foreboding. I don't know. The war is not going to end anytime soon, I guess, was one thing to take away from it. Yeah. I don't know. I wish that more horror movies, I know that it makes things more of a production if you need to get the retro cars and the retro clothes and the retro set dressing. But I think that the box office will bear this out because this movie has been performing well, as far as I know, especially with the under 18 set, as I understand it, and with like teenage girls, particularly for whatever reason. I think that there might be this wisdom in Hollywood, just bullshit, like so much Hollywood wisdom is that, you know, today's youths don't want to see their parents or grandparents' generation being assailed by ghouls. But it's actually, I don't know. I think it solves more problems than it creates if you have the budget for it.
It obviously solves the omnipresent cell phone problem.
Yeah, exactly.
We've discussed at length, including last episode. So, yeah, I think you're right there. And I mean, obviously, it's not limited to this movie, seeing that period horror works. Obviously,
most of the Conjuring movies are set somewhere in the past.
Most, if not all.
Most, if not all. Yeah, that's yeah.
It, I think, is the highest grossing horror film of all time.
Right.
And I'm sure the sequel will be in that ballpark.
Mm-hmm.
They're certainly lining it up to be like that, particularly with that fucking incredible cast of Grown Up Losers Club.
Yeah.
Bill Hader. I'm so fucking psyched.
Yeah, no, that was a real slam dunk.
So yeah, I think, as you say, it really just comes down to a budget question. Although, I mean, it all depends on what kind of scale you're going for, because it's not as though you need to have, like, mid-budget production value. And by mid-budget, I mean, like, 25 to 40 or 50 million to be able to make a period horror film, because the one that leaps to mind fairly readily is Summer of 84, mm-hmm. which, okay, yeah, it's part of the deluge of 80s nostalgia, I get it, but that movie's pretty good.
Yeah.
And it is a 1984 period piece, and it feels relatively authentic. You see a few old cars and so forth and all the old record players and whatnot. I'm not going to belabor the point, but the production design all felt legit, and I know that movie couldn't have cost more than a couple million dollars to make.
Yeah, no, you're right.
So obviously, if you're trying to make something that's taking place over an entire town, a bunch of different set pieces, and you're trying to make that as a period piece, that's going to stretch your budget a lot more. But that's not necessarily going to have to be the blueprint for every movie like this.
I guess in this case, I'm more struck by the period setting because of the material doesn't necessarily cry out for it. Like on paper, if you're like a kind of imagination deficient studio exec, you see this as a 90s nostalgia cash-in.
Sure.
You know, 90s, 80s, whenever these books originated, they were, you know, constantly in circulation, certainly in my childhood, which was in the 90s. And I think, I don't know, it was a shrewd decision to actually set the movie, like I said, in a kind of simpler time in some respects, when these sort of campfire tales would have been the scariest game in town, you know. It's pre-Manson, you know what I mean? Like 1968 is pre a lot of stuff.
Very true.
So I think that was pretty savvy on the filmmaker's part.
Yeah, no, I think you're right.
I want to fucking Are You Afraid of the Dark movie so goddamn bad I can taste it.
Yeah, just bring back Ryan Gosling. And he's the only famous grown-up actor to have been a child actor on that show, right? There are any other, like, hidden gems there?
To the best of my knowledge, there's probably one or two tucked away here and there.
For those of you who don't know, child Ryan Gosling was on Are You Afraid of the Dark on one episode of that show. So there you go. The more you know.
One quibble I had with Scary Stories is this business with a couple of the older stories in Sarah's nightmare journal. What are the name Deodat? Is that one of them?
Yes.
And yeah, so one of the stories that offed a couple of her, I think it was like her father and her brother, is called The Wendigo. And this is from one of the Scary Stories books. However, it is adapted from a story by Algernon Blackwood from the, I think, early 1900s. I don't actually know exactly what period he wrote in, but it's a story I've read. And I don't know. I just thought that was an odd inclusion because it's not like, I mean, the Wendigo is a folkloric creature, obviously, but it'd be like if one of the stories in Sarah's book was like transparently just an adaptation of a pre-existing property. It'd be like, you know, like, I don't know. Like, it's an obscure property, I admit, but for a horror junkie,
this is the story of Salem's Lot.
Exactly. Yeah, that you see what I'm getting at. And that's part of why the names are so silly. Although, I mean, the kid who finds the toe and puts it in his soup is named August. So maybe the name Deodat doesn't really stand out from the pack, but
I don't know. August at least is like a word or a name. Deodat just sounds like fucking gibberish. Like they said it two or three times before you see it on the page.
Uh-huh.
And I couldn't figure out what the fuck they were saying.
Yeah, well, take it up with Algernon Blackwood, not Alvin Schwartz.
Well, so, fair enough. Yeah,
they could have maybe left that one out.
Why'd you spill your beans?
Why'd you spill your beans?
Sorry, for those of you who have not seen the trailer for Robert Eggers' The Lighthouse.
Get hype.
Get hype, number one. But
spill your beans.
But there's the point at which Willem Dafoe in voiceover just says, "Why'd you spill your beans?" And it's literally like that unintelligible. We had to Google around for the internet's consensus on exactly what he was saying.
It's got an echo filter on it too, which doesn't help matters. But yeah, I'm even more stoked for that movie than I am for my hypothetical Are You Afraid of the Dark movie that I've been writing in my head for the better part of a decade, which is a real thing, if and when it comes, will not measure up, I'm telling you now.
Yeah, probably not.
You know, on the subject of contentious elections, so one thing that I saw a lot of a couple of years ago, 2016, 2017 to be precise, was liberals on my Facebook newsfeed consoling themselves with this idea that, like, oh, well, you know, things have taken for a turn for the worse, but at least we'll get a lot of good art out of it. You know, at least there'll be good music again. Which, you know, like, people need to stop jerking themselves off with that. It's a pipe dream.
Well, and, yeah,
and even if it was true, that's small consolation. But every once in a while, a movie comes along. I mean, recently, within the past few years, a movie will come along that is surprisingly woke for what it is. And I, in a way that does feel like pushback, And Scary Stories, for good or for ill, is one of those movies. I mean, Ramon is a pretty cool dude, and the movie is consistently goes out of its way to vilify racism in a way that, I mean, that's, you know, movies have been doing that forever because it's easy. But like here, the material didn't call out for it so much. I don't know. It's present. And it's extraneous to an extent, but not unwelcome, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. And it doesn't feel like naked pandering, at least most of the time. I was less put off by that stuff than by like the transparent sequel hook at the end. I think that's the only moment when the movie well and truly lost me.
Yeah.
And if you have to do it, I guess the right at the end is not so bad. Then you've still got 99% of the movie that you can vouch for.
Yeah.
Anyway, I mostly enjoyed this movie. I thought I was really over the moon about it for a while, at least. And then it started to go astray slightly in like the back half. But mostly it's better than average, better than it has a right to be, better than Goosebumps, like I said, you know. Yeah. And that's kind of the where the bar is set for a lot of these nostalgia, these kid-friendly nostalgia bait properties. I hope that the sequel is on par with this movie, if not better, because a bunch of my favorite stories have yet to grace the silver screen, you know, from the Scary Stories anthologies, I mean. And I would love to see them done justice.
Yeah.
I would still love a straight up just anthology horror movie in the style of Tales from the Crypt or Creepshow, but I'm not holding my breath. I think that would be kind of hard to market these days.
Probably. And the cast of youth actors are all pretty much nobody I've seen before. Like, Stella looked kind of familiar, but I couldn't place her. And I think Tommy the Bully was one of the kids from that fucking John Green adaptation. What was it, Paper Towns, from a few years ago?
It could be. Augie looked familiar to me, but I couldn't place him either.
Basically, like, they're all kid actors, and each one of them may have been in some stuff, but none of them were like the sort of kid actors who would jump immediately to mind. And adults are almost a non-entity in this movie. Stella's dad is Dean Norris of Breaking Bad fame.
Mm-hmm.
God damn it, Marie. I literally leaned over to Matt and whispered that when he first showed up, and he's eating like a TV dinner or something. And he's good, but he's barely there. And then
you got the sheriff.
The sheriff, who's played by Gil Bellows. He plays the younger convict in Shawshank, Tommy, who...
Oh, shit, yeah.
Who gets Andy... Tries to get Andy off the hook.
Greaser kid.
Yeah, the greaser kid who tries to get Andy off the hook, and then Norton kills him. And he's good, but again, he's not in it a ton.
Yeah, I didn't recognize him at all.
He's
wild.
You know,
it's been a minute.
25 years, so yeah. Yeah, everybody's good. This movie's solid. So if they do decide to make a sequel for 2021 or 2022... presumably if we're still making this podcast at that time, we'll be watching that movie.
Yeah, count me in.
Well, this has been another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And we are the Shock Doctors. We will see you next time.
First off, an apology. I accidentally called Stella Sarah twice near the end of the synopsis, which must have been confusing given that the villain is named Sarah. Sorry about that. As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, official trailer, HD, uploaded by CBS Films. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, September 8th, and we'll be discussing the new horror comedy, Ready or Not. See you then.